Hello and welcome to New Books in Latin American Studies. I'm your host, Brice Bongiovanni, and today I'm talking to Jason Ruiz. Jason is a professor of American Studies at the University of Notre Dame and the author of Americans in the Treasure House, Travel to Porfirian Mexico and the Cultural Politics of Empire, out from the University of Texas Press. Ruiz examines the relationship between cultural depictions of Porfirian Mexico promoted by travelers from the United States and the history of U.S. economic and military interventionism in Mexico during the Porfiriato and the Mexican Revolution. Jason, I'm glad to have you on the show.
Thank you very much. I'm glad to be here.
To start out with, could you tell us a little bit about yourself, where you're from, your academic career, and what drew you to this field in general?
Sure. I'm from East Chicago, Indiana, right over the border with the big city, over the Indiana-Illinois border. But I went to the University of Minnesota for undergrad and liked it so much that I stayed and received a PhD in American Studies from the University of Minnesota in 2008. Like everyone, I was looking for a dissertation topic my first few years, and I actually came into graduate school thinking I would do something on contemporary tourism. That was kind of a passion of mine, a deep interest of mine from the first time actually that I went to Mexico as a 15-year-old, took a week off of school, much to my teacher's chagrin, but to get introduced to Mexico with my family. And ever since then, I've been passionately interested in travel to Mexico, but then also what it means and how ideas about Mexico circulate through travel. So I came into graduate school thinking I would do something contemporary, but if I could tell a quick story, I was helping a friend out at the Minnesota Historical Society, maybe my second or third year of graduate school, and she was hosting class there in the archives, and you know, in between students, I started searching around and looking for, you know, Mexico and travel as keywords, and I found a really interesting description of travel to Mexico by a Baptist preacher who lived in Minneapolis that I write about extensively in a few chapters of the book, especially in the later part of the book, because the book appeared in 1914 in the aftermath of the Porfiriato, in which he describes, you know, in his title, The Devil in Mexico, one of sort of a small body of work that looked at Mexico in very scathing terms, especially revolutionary Mexico. And none was more scathing than G.L. Morrill, who went by Go Lightly and was kind of a globetrotter figure in the early 20th century, and actually a stand-up citizen in Minneapolis. I found pictures of him, for example, helping to inaugurate the first civic Christmas tree in Minneapolis, but wrote a series of scathing travel logs and, you know, became sort of an impresario of travel, like these globetrotter figures, you know, doing lantern slideshows in church basements to introduce parishioners or audiences to far-flung destinations, including, you know, he wrote books such as, you know, with titles such as Sea Sodoms and Others, Hawaiian Heathens, and The Devil in Mexico. And I argue a little bit that he reserved special venom for Mexico as a place, partially because it was so close to the United States, making it even more dangerous at the time. So going from, you know, The Devil in Mexico, I became more and more interested in kind of the era that directly preceded it in the Porfiriato. So from the 1870s to the 1910s, looking at the period in which Morrill, in particular, for which Morrill was nostalgic, as I argue in the last chapter of the book.
Right. About the Porfiriato, what exactly is the cultural context of Morrill and the other American travelers you talk about here? What exactly is their relationship to Mexico at this time? Why are they going down there? What's going on? You know, set the stage for us.
Yeah. Well, initially, a lot of Americans go to Mexico for a very simple reason. It's because Mexican and American rail lines are linked in the 1880s in El Paso, and travel to Mexico becomes newly accessible to even everyday Americans. So starting in the 1880s, you get a flood of travelogues, postcards, picture books, many different kinds of representations of Mexico that's only possible through those rail lines. So, you know, as some of your listeners might know, prior to the rail lines, travel to Mexico was still really, really difficult up until the 1880s. So the few travelogues that you see from the 1860s and 1870s mention that, you know, this arduous task of taking a steamer, usually stopping in Puerto Rico or especially in Havana, waiting in Havana for days and days for the next steamer to Veracruz, and then taking this really treacherous rail line from Veracruz to Mexico City. And but that all changes in the 1880s when, you know, you could board a luxurious Pullman car in a place like Chicago or New York or Philadelphia and arrive a couple of weeks later in relative comfort in Mexico City, which to many Americans looked like an aggressively foreign place to them. So I kind of argue in the early parts of the book that Mexico becomes really desirable as a travel destination for a variety of reasons, including that kind of exoticism that I think starts in the 1880s especially. You know, and also the cultural and economic conditions of the Porfiriato. So you start to see, for example, many descriptions and an intense focus on Mexico as modernizing. So sort of a, you know, get in before it's too late mentality that I think is creeping into a lot of travelogues from this period, where people are saying Mexico looks like old Europe. It looks like the land of the Aztecs, as so many people call it, but it's changing because the Porfirian regime is drawing Mexico ever closer to its quote-unquote sister republic, and you know they of course mean a big sister republic of the United States.
And at the same time, there are many people from the United States that you talk about who are going to Mexico to participate in this project of modernization economically and socially.
Absolutely. You know, Mexico, or the United States, is so heavily invested in Mexico at this time that many workers, many American workers, find themselves kind of stationed in Mexico, sometimes very short term, but sometimes very long term. And a lot of the cultural materials that I work with in the book, including scrapbooks and personal memoirs and letters, those all come, or many of them come, from Americans who are living and working long-term in Mexico, especially in the later part of the Porfiriato in the 1920s and the into the 1920s and 30s, people working in the petroleum industry and similar sort of heavy industry. Earlier, it's the mining industries and other sort of extractive industries.
Right. So you have a I guess you would call it a combination of two kinds of forces going on. One is this tourism to see the exotic and the foreign, and the other is this drive towards modernization, progress in the economic sphere, and they are converging in Mexico at this time and place.
That's a really good way to put it. I try to distinguish a little bit between travel and tourism, because I don't think that there's enough infrastructure and enough kind of cultural force behind calling the travelers that I work with tourists yet.
Okay.
I think of them more as travelers. That's a subtle distinction. But I don't think that they're going to participate in a tourist industry as much as they're going to kind of see themselves, and the people who go for pleasure, at least, are going to see themselves as kind of intrepid global trotters and travelers more than tourists, which I think arrives a little bit later in Mexico.
Although you do point out that the experience of these travelers in many ways sets the ground for contemporary American tourism to Mexico in the later part of the 20th century.
Absolutely. You know, I've read hundreds of travelogues at this point, maybe 1,000, but from all different manners of life, you know, from the very early parts of the Porfiriato to the 1930s into the 1950s. And what I find really interesting is a lot of them are organized in similar ways to the travel guidebooks today, at least in terms of what you're supposed to see first, second, and third. The content is, of course, really, really different. But I think that this, what I'm working with in this book, is kind of a prehistory of tourism in Mexico, in the sense that, you know, before you have a tourist infrastructure and really a tourism industry, what you have is travelers who lay the groundwork. And they themselves also distinguish between travel and tourism, because they complain about Mexico constantly. And a lot of their gripes are the fact that Mexico does not have an infrastructure that caters to American travelers like Europe does. So they want the comforts that Europe provides in this period that they're not getting, including food and accommodations. And a lot of them go really sort of, you know, angry in their travel descriptions of what's awaiting them in Mexico, largely because tourism is not yet on the ground there, and they don't see, I think, what they're doing as tourism yet.
I guess to move into talking about your particular research, the very first chapter of the book, you talk about these travelers, and particularly how they're learning about Mexico and how they're sending back what they see in Mexico, how they understand Mexico, to people still in the United States, primarily through the medium of photography. So could you just tell us a little bit about photography among Americans in Mexico at this period, the major figures, and the general outline of what you're talking about there?
For sure. I will say that, you know, looking at the history of photography in Mexico from the 1870s at the start of the Porfiriato to the 1910s, where the book really ends, is also an education in photography, and the technology and the art of making a photograph dramatically changes. So, you know, I'll use some language, but, you know, please keep in mind that it does not necessarily refer to the entire Porfiriato and the kind of photographic practices. You know, there isn't like one way for an American to take a picture in Mexico throughout this period, because it does radically change, you know, especially late in the Porfiriato and right in, during the Mexican Revolution, with the advent of handheld cameras and, you know, Kodaks that make it photography completely mobile.
Right. You note the change, I should say, between professional photographers who are working to supply sort of an industry of picture postcards and portrait photography, to photography being done by travelers and workers in Mexico themselves on their own time.
Exactly. But interestingly, I think one kind of feeds into the other. I think that a lot of what happens when people start getting cameras of their own and they start getting very highly mobile cameras, what they do is they follow the photographic practices set in place by the earlier photographers, the professionals who would arduously travel around the Mexican countryside or through the city with these gigantic cameras, sometimes, you know, hauled by mules to get to penetrate kind of previously unphotographed, or at least in their imaginations, you know, previously unseen pictures of Mexico. But interestingly, you know, some of the things that I cover in the first chapter are still popular photographic tropes, such as, you know, indigenous children, which is the cover of the book very purposefully, because I argue that if I could get kind of more specific about a particular photographer, C.B. Waite, you know, focuses extensively on and lingers upon the image of the impoverished child as kind of a national exemplar of Mexico in a way that, you know, any tourist still sees today when they're, if they stop and think about what either they're taking pictures of or what their fellow travelers and tourists are taking pictures of, you know, we still see this in place. But C.B. Waite is, I think, the driving force of my first chapter and the first photographer I got interested in who worked in Mexico during that time period, arrives in Mexico in the 1880s, is a extremely prolific photographer, you know, produces tens of thousands of images that are everywhere in the archives. You know, I can't find an archive with any representation of travel to Mexico that does not include work by C.B. Waite, but is really ignored by especially American scholars. A few people have written about him, and a Mexican scholar wrote a master's thesis and published a couple of small books on C.B. Waite, kind of using the images. But Waite, I think, really helps to shape how Mexico is pictured in the American imagination, but is also either misunderstood or underrepresented in how we think about photographic practices in Mexico, partly because his work is very, for lack of a better word, denotative. It is not yet, he's not yet working as an art photographer like someone like Hugo Brehm, who's working at the same time, actually, would be, and several, you know, Mexican photographers and foreign nationals who live in Mexico, including, you know, Frida Kahlo's father, you know, are really striving toward art in their photography. But C.B. Waite, interestingly, is more interested in the art of the postcard and the art of profit and drawing on images of Mexico throughout the period and I think sort of accidentally shaping Mexico, our vision of Mexico, because he doesn't, he's more interested in picturing Mexico as he saw it more than producing an art around it.
You note specifically his focus on children, and you connect that to the infantilization and you also note sexualization of the subject of photography that characterizes a lot of photography of the kind of colonial and imperial age. which you also note is something that has persisted in depictions of Mexico and Mexican people into modern photography as well.
Yeah. One interesting thing that happens with Waite is that he, although he has a very long career in Mexico, he lives and works in Mexico for several decades and does not leave until he's really driven out by the revolution. His brother's killed in the revolution. Both Waite and his brother, both C.B. Waite and his brother, become large landholders in Mexico. The brother's killed. Waite eventually flees, I think in 1913. But, you know, even though he had several commissions from the Mexican government to do things like, you know, photograph the tremendous progress of things like the sewer system around Mexico City, things like the paving of Mexican streets, and especially in Mexico City, also the tremendous progress made by railroads. He has government commissions, but he's also arrested in a kind of weird episode, and you know, he's put in jail for 3 days, you know, released, and I think what sounds like sort of, you know, his Mexican friends coming to his rescue, but he also, despite the fact that he is a very kind of socially sanctioned photographer, also produces what Mexicans considered dangerous images. And despite the fact that he does have many images of scantily clad women, things like that, all that kind of imperialist trope that you're referring to that we've seen in many other colonial contexts, you know, the Middle East and Africa, and Asia, you know, everywhere that sort of, you know, that colonization or imperialism is photographed, you know, it tends to come with kind of the image of it comes along with a certain set of images, including the image of the sexualized woman in need of rescue from imperialist power. But I think in the archival evidence, the charge against Waite is that he shows Mexico as degenerate. And I think that a big part of that is showing Mexico in poverty. His vision of Mexican poverty is the most dangerous aspect of his work. So I think that's something that, you know, we still contend with as travelers to Mexico, you know, even if you're a casual tourist, you know, the sort of difference between Mexican poverty and the poverty, at least as visible on the streets in the United States, is striking. And it's a very appealing and seductive subject for anyone with a camera.
To the idea of Mexico as backward. But at the same time, he's also, as you know, participating in the Porfiriato as a landholder. He has some degree of social sanction, so he's kind of straddling two different lines of relationships to Mexico, one of documenting their supposed backwardness, and the other of participating in the regime that Americans tend to think is going to bring Mexico out of its backwardness.
Yeah. And, you know, his work is subtle in the sense that, you know, it's doing both of this work at the same time. It's both documenting that poverty and the idea that Mexico is backwards, that Mexico is trapped in the past, is ahistorical in general. You know, he's doing both at the same time, which I think is also kind of, you know, still how we look at Mexico. You know, it's like the third world, but not the third world, as backward, but improvable, is still a big part of how Mexico is represented, not only through the touristic encounters, but also in so many film and television productions that deal with Mexico, deal with kind of the same contradiction or ambiguity or even ambivalence that I think color Waite's images.
To move on, I guess, to talk a bit about how depictions of Mexico translate into American attitudes towards Mexico, and especially towards the Porfiriato, you talk first about American relationships specifically to Diaz himself as a figure, Porfirio Diaz, as this kind of criticized but in many ways also idealized dictator who plays a couple of different roles. And I was wondering, could you talk a bit about that, and particularly about how you see the role of American travelers in shaping these American attitudes towards Diaz during the Porfiriato?
Yeah, great question. You know, I don't claim that I have anything new to say about the Diaz regime itself. You know, I kind of leave that to the Mexicanists, especially the historians among the Mexicanists. And I think that, you know, the regime itself is a fascinating object of study. And what I do in the book is look at something a little different, by looking at American perceptions of the as a way to get at the imperialist impulse that shaped, and especially the economic imperialism that shaped American visions of Mexico during that period. So kind of the thrust of the section of the book that you're asking about would suggest that Americans found in Diaz a really ideal figurehead of Mexico. So I write in the book about how, for example, they conflate Diaz with Mexico. And this was done all the time in with world leaders. You know, we could see this today, like Putin is Russia and Russia is Putin, you know, in the news right now as we're speaking. But they also, you know, they have a lot to contend with in terms of championing Diaz. And one of them is around race. So what they do, and it kind of, that part of the book kind of is echoed in a later chapter, is they position him, for example, as an idealized mestizo. And they argue that at times his body reflects the perfect Mexican state. So, you know, travel writers, for example, travelogue writers and photographers picture Diaz and then they write about him as, for example, having the hot temper, so the hot head of the Indian, but the cool heart of the American, or I've just conflated them, the hot heart of the Indian, but the cool head of the European. You know, they also kind of, I think, misrepresent his lineage a little bit by claiming that his father was a Spaniard, and which is contested, and claiming other things about his personal lineage. But they do frequently look at his corporeal self as a way to think about what Mexico is and what Mexico could be. They also do this through his relationship with his wife, his second wife, who's many decades his junior, distinctly more European looking, and as especially many women writers argue who are looking at Carmen Diaz, is that she's a civilizing force in Diaz's life. So even though he still possesses this fiery Indian heart, he has the cool head of a Europeanized woman who spoke perfect French, spoke perfect English, had been to Europe, unlike Diaz, prior to his exile, that he has this kind of civilizing agent in his wife. So when I started looking at Diaz, I got really surprised at how personal a connection many travelers had to claim to him. And you know, I subsequently learned through the historical work that the Diaz, government did grant access to the president to many travelers, with like the right letters and the right connections. They could have an audience with him at Chapultepec. And this encounter became a trope in a lot of the travel writing associated with Mexico, and especially associated with Diaz, because this kind of this audience that they detailed also claimed, it said something about the social stature of Americans arriving in Mexico, that, what other foreign land can you meet, so regal a president living in a castle overlooking this rapidly modernizing, ancient capital. This encounter with Diaz became extremely romantic, but also totally tied up into what Americans were hoping for Mexico, namely that it would be civilized and modernized. And they saw Diaz increasingly throughout the course of the Porfiriato as both civilized and modernized.
And to what extent would you say this relationships between individual Americans and Diaz, or between the body of American travelers more generally and Diaz as a figure, is linked to, as you put it, American economic imperialism at this time? Are they actually going in and trying to use connections for economic gain as well as sort of the social cachet they're gaining?
Personal economic gain?
More personal, but more in the larger sense of kind of this project of economic modernization in which they have both a sort of positivist humanitarian ideal, but also the goal of increasing wealth.
Absolutely. I think the central thesis of the book is that travelers who produced representations of Mexico did the cultural work of what Gilbert G. Gonzalez calls the cultural or the economic conquest of Mexico. So, and many historians have noted that, U.S. and other foreign companies and governments are economically taking over Mexico at this point, which is also a major source of tension within Mexico that leads directly to the revolution starting in 1910, around 1910. So, you know, Mexicans and foreigners are aware that that investment in Mexico comes with a certain danger, and that danger is what we now think of and what we now call economic imperialism, the fact that the U.S. had more than $1 billion invested by the time that Diaz left, you know, has everything to do with why the revolution occurred at all. But these travelers, I think, whether or not they saw themselves as doing so, they took part in a larger cultural process of representing Mexico as conquerable, but specifically as economically conquerable. So, you know, every traveler might not have seen him or herself as part of, you know, a colonizing force or an economically imperialist force.
Right.
But they still took part in a bigger project that also took pages in the or took place in the pages of National Geographic, of the New York Times, of many mainstream American publications and cultural fora that really were thinking and were considering the Diaz regime all throughout this period and wondering what role the United States could play in plotting Mexico's future. That's a big question already that appears in lots and lots of places. And I think travelers emerge as these cultural figures uniquely positioned to report back to kind of the metropole, if you will, and say, this is what Mexico looks like. This is what you find here. And this is the result of economic empire.
Right. And the one area that you spend the most time on in the book is something that combines the economic and the cultural or social elements of this kind of American reporting back and trying to think of ways to modernize Mexico. That is the way these American travelers are viewing Indians and the Indian problem in Mexico. I wonder if you could just explain for a second what that is. What is their particular concern about Mexico's indigenous population?
Well, travelers saw Indians everywhere they went, just like a traveler does today in Mexico. And of course, you know, I mean, indigenous people, I'm using the language that they would have used during the Porfiriato, and, you know, they undoubtedly would have called them Indians. And they focus on Indians and they obsess over Indians that they see everywhere throughout the Porfiriato. And I think what it presents is a problem for many of the travelers when, if they are considering Mexico's future, as I just mentioned, they have to contend with what do you do in a country where, in their view, unlike the United States, where Indians have been subdued, even though they, as they arrive in Mexico, the Indian Wars are still going on in the United States. What do you do with a country with a population as potentially unruly and uncivilizable, due to its large, extremely large indigenous population? So what I argue is that they develop frameworks and conventions and tropes that help each other and themselves to contend with this so-called Indian problem and to pose solutions to the Indian problem. So I work with many images that I found everywhere in my research that show, for example, Indians at work. So they would, National Geographic did this in particular, and Waite took many of these images, so did many of the travelers who went to Mexico, focused on the fact that supposedly unlike American Indians north of the U.S.-Mexico border, Mexican Indians, although they had all these problems, they were endemically lazy, just like Americans would have seen Native Americans. They were prone to drink. They were racially backward and potentially, you know, in their most genocidal form, potentially a disappearing race as they were in the United States, which we'll probably get to in a minute. Indians, unlike those north of the border, could be incorporated into capitalist production. So you see countless images of Indian women sorting coffee beans, Indian men drying those beans or working a field, you know, frequently with sort of what Americans at the time saw as rudimentary implements, but then also arguing, like, look how naturally hardworking the Mexican Indian is. And if we just put the right tools into his or her hand, they might emerge as something like a working population in this country. So this country is rich in natural resources, but it's underdeveloped because of A, the sort of problems of Spanish colonialism, and then B, the problems that are endemic to indigenous people. But with the right intervention, with economic intervention and managerial intervention, the Indian could be civilized into what, if not a fully modern worker, something that resembles the modern worker, or something that could help to help to foment Mexican progress nonetheless. But at the same time, you know, of course, countless images of, and by images, I mean also like sort of rhetorical and descriptions of Indians as, you know, underdeveloped, backward, in need of kind of cultural and even physical intervention. Because again, in the Mexican context, we see the image of the Indian body as endemically diseased, as physically and corporeally inferior to the European body. But as I argue in the chapter that goes along with the chapter focused on indigenous people, you know, Mexico, unlike the United States, which supposedly has strict rules prohibiting miscegenation, of course, supposedly, because, you know, miscegenation throughout U.S. history, Mexico does also already have a racial framework for removing the Indian, namely through mestizaje. So I consider also the cultural politics of mestizaje throughout the Porfiriato as told by American travelers.
Right. One thing I did want to point out is that you mentioned, of course, that Morrill, for example, who you talk about, especially later on in the book, but who appears repeatedly, is a minister. He's a Protestant minister.
Yeah.
One of the particular things that American travelers suggested as a way to help modernize Mexico's Indians was the introduction of Protestantism, because this is a period of a fair bit of anti-Catholicism in the United States, and the sense that Protestantism goes along with the superior work ethic of the Anglo-Saxon Americans.
Yeah, that's absolutely part of it. So, you know, as I include some pictures in the book, for example, that I think function as before and after pictures. So you have, and these mostly grew out of the Protestant missions themselves, which were very adept at producing visual and textual representations of their work in Mexico. So they saw themselves as a civilizing agent, as did Morrill, who laments the kind of removal of Protestant missionaries in Mexico during the Porfiriato or during the Revolution. You get these before and after pictures where before it's an image of a so-called wild Indian, you know, carrying a gigantic pile of sticks, but then after you get things like a heterosexual family with children dressed in proper Western attire. They're sort of de-Mexicanized, but more specifically de-Indianized through Protestant intervention. The other arm of this, of course, is presenting Indian Catholicism and really all Mexican Catholicism as somehow barbarous. You know, of course, the problem with that is the elites that the travelers meet and glorify and become, you know, completely, they romanticize, they become completely enamored with, are also Catholic. So they have, I think there's kind of two veins of Catholicism running through travelers' just representations of it. The sort of barbarous Indian Catholicism that, they really blame the sort of, you know, Spanish curse on, and they look at, it as a remnant of Spanish colonialism. And you get, you know, countless descriptions of travelers remarking upon things like Indian forms of penance. And there's a fabulous but a haunting image of an Indian woman paying penance that was reproduced very frequently. I think it's a weight image that appears in the book. And they become convinced that, like, Protestant conversion is rescue. But they, of course, never, ever think of trying this on the elite Mexicans, because they know that they need an elite class to kind of facilitate the cultural and economic work that they're typically proponents of.
Right.
So I think they see elite Catholicism as romantic, you know, a beautiful what they would call Spanish señorita, you know, under a thick black veil is somehow romantic. But an Indian woman, you know, crawling the church on her knees is barbaric.
This is kind of presents an interesting image of how they're also relating to the Spanish history of Mexico as something which is both this black legend of superstition and backwardsness and barbarism.
That's the word I was looking for, black legend. Yeah, thank you.
But also, this is the critical European factor that makes mestizaje something that becomes desirable to these travelers.
Yeah, I think so. That's, again, another kind of problem, an intellectual or conceptual problem that travelers have, you know, because they see mestizaje as the end of the Indian. They see it as, you know, as the Porfirian regime also would have argued for blanquimiento, as whitening.
Right.
They don't see it as the browning of a European population. So there's a real problem there because they don't see that mestizaje goes both ways. You know, of course, in the 1920s, Vasconcelos sort of argues that mestizaje would be, you know, the end of all race, and, you know, because it would create the cosmic race and something completely new. But they pin their hopes for the kind of taming of Mexico on mestizaje, and they produce some very ugly representations of Indian and indigenous sexual practices and romantic practices as a way to argue, you know, like, you know, there's horribly vicious quotes where, you know, everyday travelers, so not race theorists, not scientists, not social scientists in any way, they claim to observe that the well-to-do Indian or an Indian in possession of any intelligence marries up the racial food chain. So they marry and they reproduce with people who are lighter than themselves. And, you know, as I argue in the book, you know, the end game of that is, you know, eventually genocidal in a way.
Right. And it's worth noting, just as an aside, this is going on in a number of countries in Latin America around this period. And it's tied up in the idea of progress, because you get a similar narrative going on in Cuba and I believe also in Brazil. In places there, it has more to do with the emancipation of slaves. Mexico, I think, for American travelers, I think you note this. One reason that they can come to support mestizaje in Mexico is the relatively small number of African Mexicans. They essentially don't exist to American travelers, or if they do, they are so minor and so marginal that they're not worthy of concern.
Yes, and that's a good point, especially in sort of relating it to things like Brazil, where, you know, a large black population, an emancipated slave population, is a conceptual problem in that context. Travelers universally in the period that I look at, the Porfiriato and its aftermath, deny the existence or the possibility of black Mexicans. They do, however, claim that black Americans, so African Americans, sometimes arrive in Mexico and sometimes stay, you know, think people like Pullman porters, etc., or, you know, whatever. They claim that African Americans might arrive in Mexico. And in one passage that I cite, they say that they're sometimes seduced by these lusty Indian women in Mexico. But, you know, and many times those Indian women succeed at nabbing a black American into thinking that they, and tricking a black American into thinking that they're desirable. But inevitably, you know, that man who gets with an Indian woman comes to his senses and then abandons her, you know, like he should. So there is, you know, a glimmer of black and indigenous sort of interaction within the conceptual frame of American travelers, but they do it as a way to kind of punish and disregard indigenous women in particular. And also, I mean, since you mentioned the black curse or black legend, I would say, you know, a lot of this also accelerates around the time of the Spanish-American War for Americans who use it as an occasion to claim that Mexican backwardness is not even as much related to the endemic backwardness of Indian people as it is about the sort of problem of Spanish colonialism. And they see other forms of colonialism, including their own, or imperialism, subtle distinction there. They see their own sort of, you know, growing empire as a civilizing agent rather than something that would move indigenous people backward in time as Spanish colonialism had. You see again and again around the Spanish-American War, they say that Indian people in Mexico are worse off and more backward and further back in time than they were during the before the Spanish arrived in Mexico.
Right. in a sense, it's a hemispheric, an extension of U.S. ideas of imperialism and progress, especially, keeps coming back to that term, being extended in this sort of hemispheric hegemony. So the U.S. is claiming a role in Mexico, and it's also claiming a role in Cuba, role in Puerto Rico after the Spanish-American War as a civilizing force and kind of cutting off, in a sense, the Spanish history at that time.
Absolutely. And arguing to each other, and even in travelogues, arguing to their audiences that, you know, the U.S. is not going to, or Mexico is not going to become a new imperial possession of the United States, but that the existence of these new possessions, you know, including Hawaii, the Philippines, and, right, and places in the Caribbean, the presence of these only underscore America's responsibility in Mexico.
So in your last chapter, you talk about what happens when this kind of image falls apart because the Mexican Revolution occurs. And you talk specifically about the unique body of Americans in Veracruz, which is occupied by U.S. Marines during the Mexican Revolution. And you talk extensively about the kind of language used, the attitudes of the Americans there, how they're reflecting on the revolution, and their nostalgia for the Porfirian regime.
Yeah.
My question about that would be, to begin with, how do they experience the start of the revolution? Is this a moment of, I guess, cognitive dissonance for these Americans, realizing, in fact, the project that we have thrown our support behind has now collapsed?
Well, they're horrified by the revolution, of course, you know, and, you know, one thing that surprised me a lot was that travel to Mexico did not stop during the revolution from the Americans. So most people who know anything about kind of American-Mexican relations during the revolution know that, you know, Americans would stand on the American side of the border and watch kind of the pageantry of the revolution at time and watch battles. And, you know, there's always this sort of idea that, you know, Americans were hit by stray bullets, you know, and there's images of, you know, ladies holding parasols as they watch parts of the Mexican Revolution. But what I wanted to stress in the chapter is that Americans went deep into Mexico during the revolution. And this, the idea that a lot of the modes of representation that they perfected during the Porfiriato, so the travelogue, the picture postcard, all of these kind of modes of representation did not cease during the revolution, but merely sort of changed to accommodate what the revolution meant for American frustrations with Mexico during the period and American occupations of Mexico during this period. So there is a rich visual culture of the revolution that flourishes in the United States, including on postcards. You have horrific postcards of, you know, charred, you know, insurrectionist bodies, you know, that circulate in U.S. popular culture during the time. The frontispiece, the morals book that I mentioned, The Devil in Mexico, is in fact the image of a lynched insurrectionist. So, you know, the frontispiece is a dead Mexican. And so the practices of travel don't change, but the politics of travel change dramatically. And as you mentioned, I argue that what a lot of travelers focus on is kind of what was lost to us, you know, us being sort of the Americans, supposedly. So the idea that many Americans view the revolution as if it undoes all of their civilizing power in Mexico, and they look at the uglier parts of the revolution as a way to think about either, A, the need for intervention, which, you know, many American writers, including, you know, Jack London, talk about, you know, sort of the sort of, you know, social chaos of the revolution as a rationale for American intervention. Or they argue that, you know, that we lost something special in Mexico and we can't get it back, was kind of the other argument. But I zoom in on Veracruz for a number of reasons, partially because, you know, the U.S. occupies Veracruz a couple of times in the 1910s, but also many travelers, or some Americans who had been living and working throughout the Porfiriato were evacuated through Veracruz. So you get a lot of sort of encounters between Americans and the Mexican Revolution through Veracruz. You know, sometimes those Americans who had been living in Mexico are stranded in Veracruz or Tampico, and that becomes kind of an international crisis. But then also just Veracruz becomes a flashpoint, especially around, you know, again, to my surprise, before, as I was researching this, around issues of sexuality. So I kind of opened the chapter by thinking about the idea that the Americans who do go, including Morrill, look at Veracruz and they see sexual degeneracy as the ultimate symptom of the social breakdown wrought by the revolution.
Right. You really talk about this in the role at one point of the relationship between U.S. sailors and soldiers in Veracruz and Mexican women. And this is painted by Morrill, I think, and a couple of others as part of a larger system of like U.S. versus local relationships that is in a line stretching back to the Philippine War, the Cuban occupation, where American soldiers have been thrown in with local people and have sort of been negotiating a relationship with them, which includes a sexual relationship.
Yeah, I just hosted co-hosted a small conference here at Notre Dame, where I should have said I worked in my intellectual autobiography when you asked earlier. I work here at the University of Notre Dame. We hosted a conference on American Empire, and we wanted to include sort of a contemporary representation. And we chose the newish John Sayles film, Amigo, that also includes, you know, sort of, you know, as a very minor plot point, kind of the sexual dimensions of U.S. empire abroad. And of course, you know, anyone who studies anything about colonialism, especially in the years following kind of feminist post-colonial studies and feminist considerations of post-colonial studies, will know that, you know, colonialism, empire is always a sexual project. So I look at that from two different dimensions, you know, one of them being sort of the horrors of sexuality, you know, that appear in Morrill and related texts that look at Mexico, especially Veracruz in the context of my book, as sexually dangerous to Americans who are passing through. Right. Of course, Morrill, as I should have mentioned earlier, is titillating audiences as much as he's scandalizing them about Mexican degeneracy. So, you know, his books also contain, you know, they needlessly contain images of topless women and representations of, you know, women across the globe as some, especially non-white women, as somehow sexually available to any traveler who passes through. So he's supposed to be sort of present sexuality as horrifying in that book and in other related texts. But, you know, the other side of that is, of course, the rich visual culture that sailors produce everywhere they go, it seems. And that's also included in Mexico. And, you know, you get lots of images of sailors sort of fraternizing with Mexican women, sending postcards to their buddies back home, suggesting that, you know, Mexican women, despite what you have heard and read, are quite lovely and readily available.
This is, so another thing to mention would be that this is, again, something that is played out in the same terms in previous American imperial expeditions, but also at the same time in places like Haiti. Think of some of my own reading on the American occupation of Haiti by the Marines, which is going on about the same time. There was immense concern with sailors, soldiers going native, consorting with local women, and becoming indolent and losing track of their, you know, proper American role as kind of saviors and civilizers of the society. But at the same time, this was also something that was sold for large-scale entertainment value, which is that connection between disgust and titillation.
Absolutely. I don't know if you're thinking about Mary Renda's book there, Taking Haiti, but that's certainly, you know, a part of that book. And I don't think that the case of Mexico is singular, but I do think what it does is it reinforces a large and very convincing body of work that suggests that we need to look at the sexual dimensions of the colonial or the imperialist project. So I liked what you said about, you know, the sort of danger posed to Americans and Europeans who might find themselves in these locations, because definitely appears in the context of Vera Cruz. You know, I cite this one sort of very moralistic warning that says, you know, Mexico is not the place for a boy, you know, meaning a sailor, or I think in this context, you know, an investor or a worker who's prone to cards and drink, because, you know, the culture is endemically prone to those vices. So you kind of don't know if it reads as either a warning or a suggestion to that boy who is prone to the vice that he might want to check out Mexico. You know, I guess it's one of the ways that images of sailors, you know, have captured the American imagination in particular as both moral enforcers and amoral party goers, if you will.
Right. I would say that I think what is singular or distinct about your discussion of Vera Cruz here is that it's connected to, again, this sense of nostalgia, regret of these Americans over what has been lost because of the end of the Porfiriato. There's an American sense you talk about of that Mexicans are ungrateful to Americans, that they have not paid back all the effort Americans put into civilizing them and trying to develop their country economically and culturally. And this is, you know, sort of this sense of sad resignation that a lot of these writers are voicing, along with, I should also point out, I thought dramatically candid statements to the effect that the U.S. was a colonial or imperial power and ought to be acting as such in Mexico at that place and time.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, I definitely think that thread of, you know, the gratitude that is definitely shaped how they saw Mexico. And, you know, I borrow that, of course, from an article by Luis Perez, you know, about the Americans and American attitudes toward Cuba after 1898, that Cuba somehow owed the United States because the United States had rescued it. But there's something else happening, you know, because the United States did not rescue Mexico on political grounds. It did not rescue it from its so-called imperialist, you know, controller of, you know, the Spanish Empire. But it does claim to have rescued the Mexican economy through this massive investment, and felt like it was owed not only the rights that it had bought all throughout the Porfirian regime, but then also, you know, an attitude of fraternal or sororal gratitude from its sister republic down below. So, yeah, I think that that's a really interesting part of American frustrations and their sort of extremely negative depictions of Mexico during that period.
The final thing I'd like to ask is, again, what do you think you've talked about the relationship between American travel all through this period and current American attitudes or tourism. You mentioned that toward the beginning, and it comes back up at the end, where you mentioned, of course, that Vera Cruz becomes the epicenter of American tourism later on in the 20th century. So, in a very broad sense, what do you see as the connection between this period of travel and modern or more recent American tourism in Mexico?
Yeah, I mean, one thing that again surprised me as I was researching was how very different a trip to Mexico looked in the early parts of the 20th century to today, or when I first went to Mexico in the early 90s. So thinking about the idea that the beach vacation, for example, had not been invented. So Americans never mentioned beaches, and they never mentioned some of the forms of pleasure that we derive out of Mexico, especially beaches in today's context. You know, it's hard-pressed to find someone who's been to Mexico who has not been to a beach. But I think one of the things that's really different is they see a trip to Mexico as a trip to Europe in many ways. You know, they see it as visiting cathedrals and architecture, and they're constantly looking for the signs of Europe in Mexico. And this is often done and frequently done by the railroad companies themselves that actively market a trip to Mexico as a trip to Europe. Now, that changes in the 1930s when there's an Egyptological craze in the United States and elsewhere, and they start to market a trip to Mexico as a trip to Egypt. because of the ruins.
Right.
But I think that that's one of the ways in which, you know, travel is really different in these days. At the same time, I think that a lot of the modes of representation that we get in guidebooks and in our own travel and touristic practices has remained. You know, I'm constantly trying to get my students to ask themselves, like, look, you're not an imperial force when you go to Mexico. You personally are not practicing empire, but are there any ways in which you're inheriting an imperialistic way of seeing that country that, you know, emerges in the Porfiriato, collapses in the revolution, but then reemerges, as other scholars have argued, in the 1940s, 1950s, and 1960s, you know, are you reinforcing systems of power when you take a picture of a poor, impoverished Indian child and putting that up for display and viewing yourself in relation to that person?
Or,
and also has,
sorry. More explicitly, when you go to Acapulco or Cancun, and are there, in part, with the aim of sexual adventure, you know, the college spring break type experience.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think that a lot of those destinations are about having sex with each other among undergraduate students and not with the locals. But it's still, you know, it still positions Mexico as this, you know, capital O other space where the rules that govern your proper behavior as an American college student or any American person, you know, American identified person, like, does not, no longer hold. And Mexico as a liminal space is, you know, the longstanding trope associated with, you know, representations of Mexico, either in our popular culture, but especially, you know, through our travel. So, you know, why do we see Mexico as this other, and how can we rethink looking at Mexico as a place where the rules are off because they're somehow more backwards than those of us on this side of the border, or somehow like less modern than us.
Well, I think that's just about all the time we have today. But before we go, before I let you go, I'd like to ask you, what are you working on next?
Yeah, for my next project, I'm thinking about the idea of what I'm calling American recreationism in Mexico. So not thinking about American recreation in Mexico, but thinking about the longstanding trope of Mexico as a place where Americans go to start their lives over. So looking at various kind of artistic communities, religious communities, utopian communities, retirement communities, different groups of people that have seen Mexico as a fresh start. I'm calling the project tentatively Searching for Mañana, because I think that one of the ways that ideas about Mexico circulates kind of from the Porfiriato to the present is by thinking of Mexico as a place that's available to us, but more specifically available to start our lives over, and thinking about, again, the cultural politics of that.
Sounds really interesting. I look forward to reading it.
Thanks.
Thanks very much for being on the show. It's been great.
Thanks, Bryce. A lot of fun.